Hey everyone, thanks for listening. This is episode 9 of the Crystal Habit Podcast, and as always, I'm your host, Megan Marie. This episode, I departed a bit from the beaten path and set up an interview with some external experts in the realm of video games. We spend the better part of an hour discussing the art of video game exhibition at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. Stick around for a very insightful conversation. We round out the podcast with a chat with Carl for our regular Take 5 segment, along with another hiring update from Casey Manning leading into a very busy E3 season. Enjoy the show. Founded in 1846 and located in Washington, D.C., the Smithsonian Institution is the world's largest museum and research complex. Boasting 18 museums and galleries, the Smithsonian is renowned for its collection of art and historic works, in addition to a sizable education and research applications. As such, when the Smithsonian American Art Museum revealed its intent to explore the 40-year history of the video game and detail the medium's impact on art, culture, and entertainment in a dedicated exhibition, it was a major moment of pride for the industry. This is also true for the studio and franchise talent when Tomb Raider's inclusion in the exhibit was revealed. So that being said, I'm very excited to be talking with two key organizers of the exhibition to speak to the motivation, collaboration, and reception of the art of video games. With me, I have Georgina Goodlander, which I need to say I absolutely adore your name, by the way.
Thank you.
Smithsonian Web and Social Media Content Manager. And then I also have Chris Melissinos, the Curator of the Art of Video Games. So, hello, hey. Georgina and Chris. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
All right. So, I told you guys I was starting with a really simple but important question in our interview. So, do both of you identify yourself as gamers? And if so, what is your first video game or fondest memory?
Georgina, would you like to go first?
Sure. I absolutely consider myself a gamer. I grew up with an Amiga 500 Plus. Used to play a lot with my sister and our neighborhood friends and my mom, and I still play today with my husband.
Fantastic. And how about you, Chris?
Absolutely. I started playing video games since I was, goodness, probably 3 or 4 years old in the 1970s. I was born in 1970, so of course my first home console was a Pong machine, and I have been playing and collecting ever since. I've amassed a collection of about 43 consoles and a couple of arcade cabinets. A good portion of those systems are in the exhibition right now, so they won't be coming back to me for a couple of years. So there's a little bit of separation anxiety. But, in our household, being a parent as well, we play video games on an almost daily basis in our home with my three kids and my wife and myself. So, I've been a gamer my entire life.
If I'm a gamer, I think you need a whole new word for what Chris is.
Yeah, that is dedication, giving up some of your personal collection to put into the exhibition.
Yeah, I've already won, but I may have to get back on eBay and pick up a Saturn or something to tide me over until it comes back so I can, get some retro gaming fix in there. But
We all appreciate your sacrifice in the time being.
That's
so
my pleasure.
On to actual interview questions. Just to give a little bit of background information, Georgina, when did you first begin working with the Smithsonian, and what are your responsibilities as the web and social media content manager?
I started at the Smithsonian as an intern back in 2003, so I'm heading up on my 9-year anniversary here. I've only been web and social media manager for a few months now. It's a new position at the museum, and I'm in charge of pretty much all of our online outreach, figuring out how we want to connect with folks who might not make it to the physical museum.
Mm-hmm. I have to imagine with exhibition in particular, that was a very important facet.
Interestingly, the exhibition kind of led to this role. I think we learned through the art of video games very early on. I mean, we discovered this huge online community of passionate people about video games, and so we started connecting with them, more than a year before the exhibition actually opened. And so the exhibition was a great opportunity for us to experiment with lots of different ways to connect with online audiences, and it kind of grew into wanting to do that with other exhibitions at the museum.
Oh, that's fantastic to hear that there were some actionable insights out of the exhibition. So.
Oh, there were many. This exhibition represented so many firsts for us. It's been wonderful.
Great.
Yeah, and you know, with regard to that position too, you know, prior to doing that, since Georgina won't say it, I will. Georgina was she had conducted the very first alternate reality game ever done at the Smithsonian, or a major museum actually, and mm-hmm. it was very successful. She won actually an award was given to her by the Wayne Clough, who is the secretary for the museum and for innovation. And so, you know, it was Georgina's kind of connection to games and introducing the museum to gameplay frameworks that kind of paved the way for us to start having this discussion, which led to the art of video games.
Well, that's wonderful that you have Chris to brag about you, because I understand not wanting to necessarily do that yourself. But that, again,
I'm usually pretty good at it, but thanks, Chris.
All right, well, Chris, how about you brag about yourself a little bit? Can you give us a little bit of history of about yourself, how you were brought on board with the project, and as curator, what your task was?
Sure. So, as I said, you know, I started playing games when I was very young, and I started programming actually when I was 9 years old. I wrote my first full video game called Space Debris by the time I was 12 on my Commodore VIC-20, and which had only 3K of RAM, folks, 3 kilobytes,
wow.
which is very, very tiny. And so video games have always been, and programming has always been a fixture and part of my life. In the mid-90s, I ran the Atari and Sega forums for AOL, and always tried to make technology and games part of whatever kind of career path that I was kind of walking down at the time. When I was at Sun Microsystems, I basically created the opportunity to focus on building next-generation web-based and connected technologies for game development, so Java on your mobile phones and for gameplay and client-side APIs and server technologies, and that led to me becoming the chief gaming officer for Sun Microsystems. And that was a position that I held for well over a decade. And so I've been very involved in the industry at GDC and E3 and conferences and all these sorts of things. But it was as a collector and somebody who's not only played games his whole life, but had been around the development of video games for a very long time. I was invited into the museum back in 2009 for an event that the museum held called Smithsonian 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an event where about 20 plus senior technologists from all over the technology world were invited to the museum to help them understand the opportunities that technology could provide the Smithsonian for reaching out to new audiences and connecting with them in ways they hadn't before. It was at that meeting that I had the opportunity to meet with Georgina, and actually we connected over a common common like of a show called Big Bang Theory. I said, oh, you love that show too. You know, it just came out. And
mm-hmm.
That's kind of where the discussion started. And eventually, you know, the museum said, hey, we need to do something around video games. Georgina goes, I know the guy.
I should clarify, too, that the Smithsonian 2.0 event was Smithsonian-wide. It wasn't just at the American Art Museum. It was actually organized by the secretary, Wayne Clough. He wanted to figure out how the Smithsonian could become more relevant in people's lives in the 21st century. You know, our mission is from the 19th century. He wanted to figure out what we could do to make it apply today. So that event happened across the Smithsonian with a bunch of experts from the outside world, including Chris. And then it kind of morphed into a conversation that Chris and I had with our museum's director about what the museum might be able to do with video games.
Yeah. And, you know, it's important to point out, too, that, you know, part of my background has also been focusing on preservation and understanding the preservation mm-hmm. of the medium, the technical as well as the social issues with regard to doing so. And so I'd been involved adjacently to the IGDA's, game preservation thing. I know the folks on that. So I sat on panels with them at conferences and things of this nature. So this kind of hit all of the things that I'm truly passionate about: video games, the development, the preservation, and the cultural significance. So this was kind of the perfect storm of an opportunity for me personally.
It definitely sounds like it. So looking specifically at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, was this sort of an unprecedented exhibit, or has pop culture and entertainment been embraced within the museum in a similar capacity before?
I think this was It was certainly a first for us. We hadn't really done any exhibitions on this kind of pop culture. We did do a show on the illustrations of Norman Rockwell a while ago, which could be said to be in that vein, mm-hmm. but not quite. But we have always been at the forefront of how we collect art, how we exhibit art, and the online programs that we do too. We were one of the first art museums to have a website, one of the first art museums to have a blog. Like Chris said, we did the world's first museum-based alternate reality game in 2008. So I don't mm-hmm. think it was completely surprising that we would do this, but definitely a first.
Wonderful. So I'm sure that there are many people, because this is a podcast that is listened to globally. There's many people who won't be able to make it out to the exhibition, unfortunately. So would you guys be able to give us kind of a virtual tour or walkthrough of the highlights, the major contributors? I know that you broke down the exhibition into 5 areas of gaming that kind of punctuate the 40-year history. So can you speak to that in the core narrative of the exhibition?
Sure. So the idea behind the exhibition was to really look at video games as an art form. There have been other exhibitions that have been done that look at the art within video games. And I've seen several of them, and they're quite lovely. And so rather than just looking at, the artistry within video games, it's what do video games as an amalgam of all traditional forms of art mean as a new art form. So we've mm-hmm. really tried to take this approach to it. And as such, we divided it in a variety of different ways. There are 3 major components to the exhibition. So if you were to visit this, the first exhibition space you walk into really describes the humanity, the people behind these games, their philosophy, where they draw their inspiration from. We interviewed, I think Georgian was at 34 or 36 industry luminaries, ranging from Nolan Bushnell to Tim Schafer and Kelly Santiago and Mike and a whole variety of people, Ed Fries, Cliff Blazinski, all these guys, and really kind mm-hmm. of drew out of them, you know, what was important with regard to video games and why do they feel it's the medium in which they wanted to craft their stories, to bring their experiences to the world and find deeper meaning in them. We show a lot of concept art. We show the progression of mechanics, how things like a jumping mechanic, let's say from Pitfall on the Atari VCS, how that same mechanic is then demonstrated over and over and over again through time, through Tomb Raider, mm-hmm. right? Leading mm-hmm. all the way to something like Uncharted 2. When you see Nathan Drake leaping for a vine and you see Pitfall Harry leaping for a vine, you realize the mechanic has held over time, but the technology gave the artist a much broader palette in which to pull mm-hmm. from, a bigger canvas on which to paint. So we talk about the people and the humanity behind it in the first area. And I should also mention there's one incredible piece here called Gamers, where this was designed by Michael Mansfield, who worked with us at the Smithsonian, and he came with this idea of videotaping people playing these games with a mm-hmm. high-def camera alone in a room. And so by themselves, they're sitting there talking to the game, and their bodies are moving all over the place, and you can actively see them think. It's an absolutely wonderful piece. So you go into the second area, and in this area we have 5 games, 1 game from each of the 5 eras represented in the exhibition, and each of these 5 games did something different in their respective era that changed not only the way people played games, but also the way designers and artists looked at game creation. So we have games in there, Pac-Man, Super Mario Brothers, The Secret of Monkey Island, Myst, and Flower. And so each one of those games did something very unique and different in their era to change perceptions of games, the way designers looked at them, so on and so forth. And then the final area is the evolution of the art form over time. So we started the Atari VCS, we ended the PlayStation 3, and you kind of traverse these 20 systems that span these 40 years, and you can follow the progression of these games that are displayed above each one of the systems over that trajectory. And so rather than having people play them, which just would not be conducive to an art museum, we have 60 to 90 seconds of annotated footage that accompanies each one of the games. So people can get a better understanding of what the artist was intending, why it was important, and what it meant in its era.
Well, obviously, we're not able to replicate the exhibition online. We have put all of the interview videos online, and there mm-hmm. is additional content that we weren't able to fit in the physical exhibition that's available on the website, too, because those are such an important part of the exhibition that we were able to talk mm-hmm. to all of these wonderful video game designers. So that is, if you're not able to come to DC, you can at least watch those videos.
Yeah, and I should also mention we wrote a companion book to the exhibition called The Art of Video Games from Pac-Man to Mass Effect. And in there, we actually draw out the 80 games, Tomb Raider, which is also included in there, where people can actually go through and read further descriptions and expansion on those ideas that we were not able to incorporate into just 60 or 90 seconds of video. So there's a variety of different ways that people who can't make it out to the museum can explore more of the materials, more of the study that went into creating the exhibition.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually going to revisit that a little bit later towards the end of this interview because I know that Square Enix members North America is currently doing a contest for bits of that book. So I'll return to that in a minute. I'm curious right now as to what degree of the exhibit was curated by the public and if this is a common practice or if it was a decision made to kind of hold to the interactive theme of the exhibition.
Well, the idea behind the allowing the public to have a say in the materials, it's very important to clarify that this was not an open vote in which we allowed the public to help vote on the 80 games that sit in that third component of the exhibition. This is a carefully curated list of 240 games, which we allowed the public to help whittle down to make sure that their voice was heard in the exhibition they were going to come and see. And I felt very strongly about this for one particular reason, which is that there is the premise that we set up that informs the narrative for the exhibition is around what we call the three voices of video games. Right? The first voice of video games is that of the designer or the artist, right? Crafting an experience and using video games to bring that to the player, to the public. The second voice is the game itself. It's the mechanics of the game. It's literally that mechanical vocabulary, how you are to interact with the game, how it communicates to you as the player, what it is you are to do and how you are to engage it. But the third voice is the player. And this is where video games stand apart from any other form of art. It's because it is in the playing of the game that art emerges, right? That the art of video games is then realized. Because you and I and Georgina can each play through Tomb Raider, let's say, on the Saturn, and we can get to the same points, we can get to the end of the game, but we may take away very different pieces of information or experience out of that journey. We don't do that with books. We don't do that with movies. We can do that with video games. So if we're staying true to the three-voice premise of the narrative, I felt it was important that the voice of the public, who has as much love and admiration and personal connection to these games, had their voice represented as well.
I think this is certainly the first time that our museum has done, had the public help select the works for an exhibition. It's not the first time this has been done by a museum in general, but museums as a whole are really looking for ways to become more participatory in how they put together exhibitions, how they run programs, things like that. So this seems like the perfect opportunity for us to experiment with doing a public vote like this, because for all the reasons that Chris just listed, it was the ideal medium for it. It's a participatory medium. The player is essential to understanding it as an art form, so it just seemed completely natural to let the public help us choose the works.
Yep. And so the voting was open from February 14, 2011 to April 17, 2011.
Yep.
What did it seem like the motivating factor was for individuals casting their votes? And was it an international voice? Were any communities more active than others? And were there maybe any surprise wins?
I think we got 119,000 votes. 119,000 people voted. They cast 3.7 million votes, and they represented 175 countries. So that was phenomenal. Definitely very international. I think a more international audience than we are used to at the American Art Museum. And it certainly generated a lot of debate. What surprised me was we did have some concern that just the best-selling games would win in every category or the most popular games, and that absolutely did not happen. People, for the most part, were extremely thoughtful. They considered what they felt was the most artistic game in each category, and they voted for it. And we were shocked because, I mean, the public said that they were concerned, too, that this just meant all the best-selling games would be on view. Absolutely not. If you go through and look at which games won, there are a lot of surprises in there.
Right, and I think to that point, I had received many emails from people that said that they refused to cast all their votes because what we did was we didn't just let them go to pick any 80 out of this list of 240. Each of these, we had them broken down into four very large bucketized genres of games, adventure, target, action, and tactics. And so within those buckets, you were able to go ahead and pick one of three games that fit either any of those genres for any particular platform. So it wasn't just this wide open vote. So what happened is there were some people that said, well, I have no experience with, you know, these systems, so I won't cast a vote against that because I couldn't discern which I view is to be more artistic than the other. We had other people that said, I refuse to vote because how dare you put me in that position, right? which is wonderful. And the one that really sticks out in my head, which was very difficult for me too, was on the Super Nintendo. Under Adventure, we had Chrono Trigger, Earthbound, and Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past. And people are like, you jerk. All three deserve to be in there. And I said, I don't disagree with you. However, this is one of the problems that's actually highlighted and kind of brought more attention to when it comes to, I believe, curation, which is even for the curator, right, as I'm the guest curator here, all the games that I chose were not in the exhibition. There were systems that I personally would have liked to have seen there, but because they didn't serve the broader purpose of this, had to be omitted. So for the record, I chose Chrono Trigger, but Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past one. So it was really very interesting. People were very careful, and they were very very respectful of how they voted. And I thought it was pretty wonderful. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it sounds like it was sort of a with great power comes great responsibility moment where they realized that they had a real degree to influence and took it very seriously. So that's fantastic to hear. So
just the fact that there was so much discussion about all the games that we left off the list is wonderful too, because it just generated this whole conversation about what should be in a museum and what shouldn't, and not everyone agrees on that.
Yeah, I got everything from, why didn't the museum hire anybody that knew anything about video games? Obviously, they would have chosen, you know, X, Y, or Z, and it's like, yes, I understand Planescape Torment is a beautiful game. It just did not fit the narrative or the space in which we had. I'm sorry.
If gamers are one thing, they are unbelievably passionate, so I can see that it would spawn a lot of debate about that. I have to visit Tomb Raider at least once in an extended capacity, because we were very excited to find out that the franchise was going to be highlighted in the exhibit. So Tomb Raider was chosen as one of the games to be showcased on the Sega Saturn, and from the standpoint of what I'm going to refer to as a gaming scholar now, Chris, what made Tomb Raider a standout title in the transition phase, which is where it ended up being placed?
Well, you happen to pick the era that I'm probably... I guess I feel most romantic about, right, is the transition era. And there's a reason why. During the era of the Saturn and the transition era, what was happening was almost this visual struggle for artists and designers. We were moving from a world that was principally had a tremendous amount of experience in building two-dimensional experiences. And there's a whole artistic process and a mechanical process that has been built up over time. And so all of a sudden, it was as if, you know, the technology world turned to all these game developers and artists who had been building in 2D for years and said, fantastic, you've done all this work in painting. Now create your next game by sculpting it. Mm-hmm. And so there was this very real visual, this struggle that emerged there. Tomb Raider happened to sit right in that era, that transition into 3D, and helping people to understand the possibility space that could be afforded them if we moved in that direction. And there were other games in that era and around that tried to do this, but Tomb Raider did something different. It was from a level design, from the fact that there was a very strong female character as the principal character in this, and not surprising the player as in Metroid, right? They go, oh, well, you know, Samus is one of the first. Yes, but nobody knew until the end of the game. And she removed her helmet that you'd been playing a woman, right? So you're taking up this role, and it just, it forced a conversation about that type of game, about the importance of women in gaming, the female character in gaming and in that narrative, and what could be achieved by moving into this new style, this new artistic space from the old. And Tomb Raider fulfilled all of those things extraordinarily well, aside from the fact that it had very compelling gameplay as well. So it was able to tell this kind of grand sweeping narrative that sat on top of all these other things. It was just kind of sat right in this perfect storm of accessibility and progression. And so for me, it represents all of those things within that era. And that's why it was selected.
Yeah, it's kind of the same. I speak to, obviously, being the community manager for the franchise, I speak to a lot of fans who echo the same sentiment. And I actually do hear the term perfect storm echoed a lot, feeling representation, especially with females for the first time, and phenomenal gameplay at the time. I remember the graphics being so astounding that I just sit there and flip about and stare at the water and the effects and whatnot. So it's very exciting as a fan to see Tomb Raider being represented in this way in the exhibition.
It was interesting because I had some people say to me, well, why didn't you do it on the PlayStation versus the Saturn? And and this is, I think, a little bit of where I have some license as the guest curator to say that in creating the narrative, part of what you see in the exhibition is me. All of the video principally that you see for most parts of the game are me actually playing the game. And so I constructed the narrative in there that Georgina and the awesome team at the Smithsonian helped to whittle down and say, you can't say all of this. You have to say this. Right? So they have become more succinct. As you can tell by talking to me, it's not one of my strong suits. And so I said, look, this is where I first experienced Tomb Raider on the console platform. And it was in the Saturn. And I remember where I was. And I remember the feeling. And I remember kind of the observation, the framework that I had at the time. So I had the opportunity to take a little license, and that's where it meant the most to me, and that's why it appeared on the Saturn.
I do want to ask you, because I know that your research for this exhibition must have been absolutely exhaustive, especially now that I'm finding out that you donated some of your personal collection, you played through for the videos and all that.
But yeah, Chris captured all of the footage that you see in the exhibition, too. I don't think he slept for, 3 months last year, late summer, early fall.
So what I'm interested in learning is if there were any fun stories or tidbits of information that you learned about particular franchises or character designs or things that many people may not know about during your interviews. I was watching something online, I think it was the webisode where you guys revealed the 80 games to be featured in the exhibit, and I learned for the first time about why Mario has a mustache. So do you have stories similar to that that you discovered in this process?
Georgina, do you want to?
Well, you know what story I'm going to tell.
Please, go ahead.
I was going to talk about the response we had from some of the game companies when they had to review footage.
Oh, yeah, that was a good reveal. Okay. You know, the fact that I had to play through all of these games, it's very interesting. One of the things that I learned most was I have a completely newfound respect for testers.
Mm-hmm.
Let me put it that way. There's a difference between playing a game for enjoyment versus playing for it to actually get to the thing that you need. And I wasn't always, I didn't necessarily approach them with necessarily the care that I would have had I been playing them for the experience. So, Georgina, if you'd like to go ahead and tell them what at least one developer said.
Yeah, there were some of the companies that we were working with that needed to review footage before we could go ahead and put it in the exhibition. And there were, one came back and told us that whoever had been playing the game in the footage wasn't good enough at the game. So they actually ended up providing us with the footage so that they could have a good enough person playing it. But it's very difficult, too, when you're capturing live gameplay footage to make it look smooth, because it doesn't when you're just watching it. So
that's
one of the
challenges. You also have to try to be cinematic and keep in, keep in context the camera and whatnot. I have the same understanding and appreciation from when I demo games with audiences, where you have to stop and have a beat and pan the camera and whatnot.
I mean, Georgina, thank you for that support. And you bring a really good point, which is, you know, in trying to make sure that I pulled things out of the games that I wanted to highlight, things that fulfilled the goal of the narrative that we set up, meant literally trying to go and manipulate someone else's, you know, someone else's point of view, trying to go ahead and use someone else's mechanics and system and camera movement and these sorts of things to convey what I needed to. So it's, you know, imagine every time you pick up a different camera to take a picture, dealing with entirely different controls. And so it's exactly, you know, one of the issues. But I will give you a great tidbit that I discovered in the interview process. Don Daglo, who worked on the Intellivision platform and created a whole incredible series of games, one of them was called Utopia, which is on the original Intellivision. And it was the very first God sim game, right, where you basically are building things on your island, and you have to deal with natural disasters and you know, encroaching armies and all these sorts of things. And he got the inspiration for building this game because he used to be a middle school teacher in the 70s. And one of the things that he did was he went to the cafeteria one day. He looked at the floor and realized that the floor is made out of tiles, linoleum tiles, which is exactly how a game designer looks at constructing a world, right? It was tiles at the time. And what he did is he took the electrical tape and he made a map of the globe. And then he brought his students in and he had them stand on different countries. And then they all engaged in, diplomacy simulations and trade simulations and these sorts of things. And so he was teaching them about global frameworks and policy and these sorts of things. And from that was born the God game genre. So it came out of teaching students in middle school that this pioneer in the industry then created and tried to go ahead and bring that sort of gameplay framework into video games. I think that's fascinating.
I think my favorite tidbit was from the interview with Ken Levine, because I'm a huge fan of the BioShock games, and I knew that BioShock was based on Ayn Rand's novels. But what I didn't know, and he talked about in the interview, was that, you know, he was fascinated by Rand's books with the idea that her heroes were always completely flawless. So he wanted to take that concept, but then imagine a world where the hero had flaws and see what would happen. And that's what, you know, that's what created Rapture and BioShock, and that's where you find yourself in the game. And that, to me, is fascinating, because it's a really interesting take on the kind of the worlds that Ayn Rand created in her books.
And I do have to ask for you guys to expand upon the Mario mustache thing, since I brought that up, because that was one personally that I found was really interesting.
Sure. I mean, it speaks to what happens when there is intent that needs to overcome limitation.
Mm-hmm.
So when Shigeru Miyamoto was creating the character Jumpman, right, which then became known as Mario, he only had a very limited resolution and palette in which to work. And so the reason Mario wears a hat is because they couldn't draw hair to make it look like hair. Right? And so you put a red hat on top of this little blobbish head, and all of a sudden you have a hat. He wears different colored overalls because they couldn't do very detailed animation. So by having contrast between the arms and the overalls, right, the sleeves of the shirt and the overalls, he created this sense of structure of the body. And he has this kind of bulbous nose, and because they couldn't go ahead and articulate the nose versus the face, they remove a block. And when they remove a block, and there's Jumpman standing on a screen that has a black background, it looks like he has a black mustache. I would imagine that if it was a yellow background, he would have looked like he had a blonde mustache, right? So so it's out of that necessity to create, and faced with those limitations, how they overcome them ultimately is what comes out. And that's how Mario has these sorts of iconic characteristics. And that became part and parcel of his character.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear that these iconic traits were born out of technological constraints. And it's also a real testament to the ability to overcome those constraints and the creativity that developers had back then. So I personally found that one quite interesting. So I want to move on to when the exhibit opened. So it opened on March 16th, correct? Yes. What did the Smithsonian American Art Museum do to mark the occasion? Because I know it wasn't like a just necessarily a open the doors and here's the exhibition. You guys celebrated.
We did a lot.
I'm still recovering
from that. We held so March 16th was opening day. That was a Friday. We held a three-day event called Game Fest, which was fully open to the public on the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So it included panel discussions with key video game designers and pioneers. We had keynote talks by Nolan Bushnell and Robin Haneke and Hideo Kojima. We had we have a huge covered courtyard in the center of our museum. It's one of the biggest event spaces in DC. So we filled that with a ton of stuff. We had live musical performances from 8-Bit Weapon, Compute Her, and Triforce Quartet. We had live action video games from Spontaneous Art, which were fabulous. And if you see the photographs online, it's all the people in the kind of lycra, shiny bodysuits throwing things at each other. We had open play consoles in the courtyard with a lot of the consoles that didn't make it into the show. We gave people the opportunity to play. And we had different consoles representing right from the beginning through to contemporary games. Chris, what else did we do? What am I forgetting?
Oh, my goodness. We showed Tron and the King of Kong, right, in the museum. We did book signings and meet and greets. And there were art things, pixel art, where kids could go ahead and take – well, anybody could. I did it, too.
Well, it was supposed to be for kids, but I think we had more grown-ups playing that than anybody else.
Oh, it was fantastic. People going and create, the 8-bit – or these bitmapped images of everything from, Mario mushrooms and fire flowers to, other 8-bit art. So it was just this whole celebration of the art that goes into making – this amalgam of art forms that then comes forth as video games. And it was unbelievably packed.
That was amazing. We had, over the 3 days, we had 23,000 people visit. And the Saturday, March 17th, was the fifth busiest day in the history of our museum.
How wonderful.
It
That's
was
so
crazy.
it was pretty insane and just so wonderful. And, one of the things about the exhibition that, that I've communicated in the museum basically at every turn, and again, it's the same center that makes it into a lot of the public discussion, was the one thing that I really wanted to see achieved, I think really was achieved, which is the connection that video games provide across generations. And the observation that I had in being able to quietly stand in a corner for a brief few minutes and just watching how people interact with each other in front of these games was, it just speaks to the deep, deep connection that video games have in society across multiple generations. And the fact that all of us that grew up playing the very first video games are now in our 40s, and we're raising gamers of our own. And so it is no longer relegated to, it must be the plaything of children. No, it was, and all of those kids grew up, and they're raising children. And it was just, it was very emotionally overwhelming and very satisfying to see that what I hope was achieved. I think pretty much, right, Georgina?
Oh, absolutely. And still now, every time I walk through the exhibition, you see kids kind of explaining the contemporary games to their parents and then the parents explaining the early games to their kids. And we've had a lot of feedback from parents saying, my son had never played the original Super Mario Brothers and now he absolutely loves it. It's just wonderful to see those connections being made. I'd have to say but we have discovered that gamers are the best people at forming lines and being polite and respectful in lines. And oh my goodness, we had on the Saturday, the line for the exhibition circled the entire museum, which takes up two city blocks, and was practically meeting itself at the end. And I don't think we have ever had such polite, patient, respectful, wonderful people in line at the museum before. So that is a testament to gamers. They were awesome.
Yay!
So speaking to you know, all the foot traffic that's now working its way to the American Art Museum. Have you seen a change or a shift in the demographic that attends the museum because of the exhibition? And do you feel that the exhibition has helped to further the understanding of and respect for gaming as an industry and as a medium?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know that the demographic has changed too dramatically because we've been working for a long time on attracting younger audiences, more diverse audiences, families, young adults, that kind of thing. But I definitely think we're probably skewing more male than we were before. I don't have any numbers on that. That's just my perception. And definitely huge, huge numbers of families coming through together and people saying that they would never have otherwise visited our museum if not for this exhibition, but now they plan to come back. I think that is the most most wonderful thing for us to hear, is that they wouldn't have visited us before and we've got them in the door and now they're excited about us in general and they want to come back and see other things.
So the exhibition has acted sort of as a gateway to the rest of the museum.
I think so, yeah. I mean, we've definitely had a lot of feedback from parents who say, you know, it's the first time they haven't had to drag their kids to an art museum. So, yay.
Great. Great.
But it isn't the first thing we've done in that kind of with that kind of goal. So.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Chris, then do you obviously as a curator feel like the exhibition has helped to further the understanding of the of gaming and appreciation of it?
I think even more than that, what it's done is it has made people realize that the things that they were engaging with all along have had more meaning than they believed it to have. I mean, one of the things that has been really interesting to observe is what happens when, you know, the latent gamer comes in, somebody who played for a period of time and for whatever reason stopped. And either the romance of games or these sorts of things just kind of fell away from them and they forgot. And it's watching them reconnect. It's watching when they get in front of something that speaks to them and they go, oh my God, I remember when I did this or I did that. And this was so important in my life. And I remember the feelings that I had. And all of it just comes flooding back to them. And they're so appreciative of that. And, you know, I've often said that, you know, people have asked, well, why didn't we do this before now? Why did it take 40 years for us to hold video games up and look at them and start to really have the discussion about them as an important form of art? And I always say it's because we lack the maturity of our vocabulary. We didn't realize that this is what we were engaging with when we were younger because we didn't have the maturity and the hindsight to understand that. We do now. And so it's kind of watching that the reignition of love of video games, of meaning, and see ourselves reflected in it. That has been the most rewarding thing. You know, is it going to help? I hope. But for me, it's already been fulfilled. I've gotten some of the most amazing emails and sentiments sent to me by people who have attended the exhibition that said, you know, this makes me feel like I matter. This makes me feel like what I do is important. This makes me, you know, all these sorts of sentiments that come out of it. It's more than I could have hoped for, and I'm just absolutely blown away by the outpouring from the public. It's been awesome.
I think
it was all worth it.
For our kind of regular museum audience, for the non-gamers who come through the exhibition, we've definitely seen that it is helping knock down some of the stereotypes about video games and also just show people the vast potential for expression that exists within these games. I think we've had a lot of feedback from people just like, I had no idea video games could do this. I didn't know you had video games about these types of things. And that has been wonderful as well, because one of my personal goals was reaching out to the kind of the non-gamer skeptics out there and showing them how wonderful this medium is.
Yeah, it's funny. Just to tie that close there is going in to train the docents that would be in the exhibition to help guide people through it. You know, typically they skew a little older, and typically there's many more women than men that do this. And so I'm getting up and explaining to them the importance of this. I can't tell you how many of them have come up to me and said, I will never look, not only have I never considered video games before, now I do, and I will never look at them the same way again.
Like, wonderful.
And it's things like, I've never played video games, but I now understand why they're important, and I can see what you mean when you say they are, you know, an art form. It makes sense to
that
me.
Is, that is a perfect transition into my next question, because I actually want to broaden the scope of our conversation just slightly as we wrap up. There are a number of games that are repeatedly referenced as games as art, including, you know, Eco, Flower, Okami, Braid, Passage, one of my personal favorites, Machinarium, Limbo, and so on. So where do you two fall in the argument of games as art? Are video games art inherently or contextually, or how do you feel about that subject?
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Give me the difficult question first.
I'm happy to answer first. I was
No. I think all video games are expressive. I think, as with all art, there is a vast range in in the type of expression, and then also whether, I mean, art is always subjective. So it's really up to the viewer to decide whether an individual game is art. I think one thing we wanted to do with this exhibition was really look at all kinds of games. We didn't want to narrow the view to just those that have been traditionally viewed as art. We wanted to say that all games can be art. Are they all art? Well, that's up to you.
I hold the same position. In fact, in the intro text that adorns the wall when you first come in, the last statement in the intro text I wrote is, they may even be art. Right? It isn't to draw a line in the sand and say definitively, yes, art, because, as Georgina said, it is very subjective. Having said that, I have a very serviceable definition of art. It serves me and my tastes very well. And quite simply, is that I believe if you can observe and understand the intent of a designer or an artist and find personal resonance with that message, then art has been achieved. Because that's what it's about. It's finding the personal connection between somebody else's message, somebody else's work, and what they're imparting to the world. It's very simple. And I can tell you that I've spent a lot of time through this project and, you know, in touring museums and things where I've never felt the same range of emotions in front of any other works of art that I have in playing certain video games. You know, and I've been able to see everything from, you know, early folk American artists at the American Art Museum, the Smithsonian, to going and seeing The Last Supper in Italy. You know, it runs the gamut, but I've never been so moved by a piece of artwork that I have in playing certain games. So for me, video games are the ultimate form of art, for me.
I have an easier question for the last one. Sticking with the art theme, but slightly simpler, what games personally top your list as the most visually striking or beautiful games?
Ooh.
It's a tough one, right? I can go first if you guys want some of my perspective and give you a second to think.
Yeah, give me your perspective.
One of my personal favorites, I listed several of them earlier, would be Odin Sphere and Okami, two of the most striking, beautiful. Like, just looking at a screenshot absolutely astounds me. And I actually really enjoy the fact that the exhibition uses the Elusive Man screen from Mass Effect 3. So,
yes, we like that image.
It is. Yeah. Oh, it's stunning. The color palette and everything in it is so wonderful. It's one of my favorite pieces of imagery from the entire industry. So more like, I'm just curious as to what you guys have found the most beautiful, visually striking games in the years that you've been playing.
Oh, boy. I'd say things like Legend of Zelda Link to the Past. That transition when we got into that 16-bit era from what we had seen with 8-bit was just so, I don't know, it was delicious, right? It was just this, all of a sudden it was the refinement of what had come before. Shadow of the Colossus. I just, just the vistas and the environments that the game places you in, they're breathtaking and they're startling. I will take, games like Myst when I first encountered it. It's actually a very scary game. If you play it alone and in the dark, it's this very isolated sort of thing, but the art really conspires to create this fear of dread in you. But, you know, visually striking, those are three.
Those are very good examples.
I think mine is going to have to be Heavy Rain. I just don't think I've ever been so blown away by the kind of immersive nature of the visuals of that game, never mind the story and the emotional involvement. But and then talking, you know, getting to interview David Cage as part of the development for this and finding out what went into creating that world, it was absolutely incredible. I mean, they did motion capture on 90 actors to get all of that. And what was fabulous is he talked about how many of the actors, you know, thought this would be easier than acting in a movie without realizing that they would have to play every possible outcome of every scene with realistic emotion. And that they all realized afterwards that, no, it was like nothing in comparison to acting a movie. But that game is just, that is an incredible game visually.
I was going to say, one of the moments that really stuck with me with Heavy Rain was the scene in the convenience store. And I found myself wanting to momentarily disregard the narrative and just look at the shelves. I mean, the shelves, the items, and the brands that they came up with for random little bits and bobs on the shelves was absolutely fascinating and stunning.
Yeah, the level of detail in creating that world. And same with Fallout 3. Too. I mean, especially because that's in D.C., so there are a lot of familiar landmarks as you explore that world. But the level of detail is just incredible in contemporary games.
Yeah, see, now I'm a little older than the both of you. So when I first experienced that same sense of immersion was with Shenmue on the Saturn.
And
being able to do things like, for the first time, walk into a room, open up any drawer, and in there is something you can interact with, and picking stuff up off the shelves, and playing arcade games, and all those things. That is when you know, I first experienced the full eyes reactive entertainment, or whatever it was that they had called it, which was basically QuickTime events, right? So, that game, just absolutely beautiful. Another game, too, recent one was Alice, the new Alice by... the new version that came out, just incredibly artful and just grotesquely beautiful. Right? So.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with all of those. So on our way out, I just wanted to give you guys a chance. Are there any personal projects you guys are working on that you want to share about? Is there online outlets that you guys want to throw out that we can keep up with you on the web if people are interested in the work that you're up to?
For the museum... We have an email sign up. If you head to the museum's website, there's a little sign up link at the top, and you can customize what you want to hear about. And that way you'll get to hear about all upcoming stuff at the museum. Hopefully we'll have a lot of exciting new projects to share in the next few months.
Great. And how about you, Chris?
So I'm involved with those projects at the museum, and of course, you know, the museum, the exhibition will be traveling to 10 more venues through the beginning of 2016. Did I say the museum or the exhibition? The exhibition will be traveling.
Yeah, we're not moving the museum.
Yeah, the exhibition will be traveling. Yeah, that is going to be a huge feat. The exhibition will be traveling to 10 more museums through the beginning of 2016, so make sure you check the museum's website to see where.
Yeah, if you sign up for email announcements, we'll be one of the categories is video games. And if you sign up for that category, you'll get all information about the exhibition while it's still here, but then we'll be sending out details of all the different venues that it travels to as well.
Right, and then you can follow the stuff that we're doing on Twitter. So mine is at C. Melusinos, and the tag that we're using is TAOVG, the Art of Video Games.
Okay,
so you can hit us on Twitter to find that.
Wonderful. So, like I said, I'm going to revisit the Art of Video Games book really quickly. Finishing off with the exhibition, the Art of Video Games runs from March 16 to September 30. And if you can't make your way to the museum, like I said, you can purchase the book online, and I will link to it in our show notes. However, before purchasing the book, it's worth noting that North American Square Enix members is currently giving away copies of the Art of Video Games in a contest that runs through April 23rd. So you don't have a lot of time left to enter, but it's a pretty easy method to enter. So you need to compose a 100-word or less statement about the most inspiring video game memory that you have and share it as a comment on the corresponding Square Enix Facebook page or at the official Twitter account. And again, I'll make sure that those links are in the show notes so that you guys can properly find them and enter the running. So thank you both so much for being on the show. I very much appreciate it, and I really enjoyed the enlightening conversation about such an important moment in gaming, and I really think that our listeners will too. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very much. It was a pleasure speaking with you as well.
All right. Hello, everyone. We are back for Take 5. I have Carl here. How are you doing, Carl?
Good, good. You may all find that my cough is gone, finally.
Yeah, the last couple of podcasts, you've been like under the weather or something along those lines. You have a nice, strong voice this time.
Back to normal.
Well, that actually, 50%. That kind of plays right into our first question, because this is actually one not necessarily related to Tomb Raider, sort of tangentially, but I actually get this a lot of times. What is it like traveling to a press junket? How long are you away from home? How do you deal with language barriers? Have you ever had any like surprises thrown your way? And like, what's your favorite sort of place to travel? Because this is a lot of what you do, Carl, is you do public-facing yes. press sort of events.
So there's two sides to what I've been doing over the last probably 2+ years now doing this for Tomb Raider. I traditionally fly in from a business side and sort of look at overarching plans and work with all the territories and sort of set out our goals and our vision for the franchise. And because of that, obviously as a spokesperson, we kind of eat, sleep and breathe it. So therefore, we're then asked to do the sort of press side as well. So we spent a lot of time over the course of the entire year. Last year is a great example. You know, we started the year with Game Informer, flew up there, you flew down here. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden it was like into some big GL presentation. So to say, here's the future of the franchise. Here's where we're going to go with it. So we had to fly around doing business stuff. And then once you do that, that opens up a whole awesome can of worms to be able to sort of follow up with loads of partners. Then you're on press tours. Most of you follow me on Twitter. Kind of saw that between Germany, France, Tokyo, London. I was all over the place.
Russia.
And it's fun. You fly in. It's a mix of trying to see everybody, trying to stay as motivated and passionate about the products, which we all love, day in, day out. You get a lot of the same questions coming at you, which, you know, I do my best to try and make sure that I give the same passion behind them. But obviously hearing the same thing about, tell me about Lara, kind of after a while, you're like, okay, give me another question.
And a lot of times you're in the same room and it's just like, it's like a revolving door where it's, you have 5 minutes, you get a drink of water and then the next
exactly.
time
Exactly.
Starts.
Ingramir is a great example of turning up at the show, going up to my hotel room, not even my hotel room. It's a hotel room with a bed taken out and two sofas and a big poster put behind me. And every 30 minutes for 3 days, it's back-to-back interviews. And you talk about the product and you do what you got to do. And then that night, generally, you're out talking to business partners to try and make sure that you catch up with them too whilst you're there. So it's exhausting, absolutely exhausting, I will say. I love it. Don't get me wrong. I think it's awesome.
What's the longest you've been away in one stretch?
I think 2 weeks was the longest that I've been away. I think I left and I actually took some time rather than flying back from Europe and then back to Europe again. I actually took some time off with family who live in the UK as well, and then continued my travels. So that was the longest. And then the shortest, I think the shortest, I actually have two of them. I have the shortest and I have the strangest. The shortest was like less than 36 hours flying to London and back for one meeting, which was hard. Well, wasn't that hard because I didn't adjust. I literally just landed, did my meeting and came back. And then in the space of 4 days, again, anybody who saw me on Twitter knows I did. I circumnavigated the world in less than 4.5 days. I flew from here to London, did a set of meetings in London, then hopped on a plane, flew to Tokyo, did a set of meetings in Tokyo, and then hopped on a plane and came back. And I don't think my body ever
caught up. It didn't
ever caught up.
Time to get used to anything.
It certainly didn't thank me either because I was ill for a little bit after that. But yeah, it's all fun. I will not complain, but it's tiring. I think for anybody who sees it, don't think it's a jolly. If you see how jet lagged I am in most of my meetings.
So your voice now is going to be robust for another couple of months, and then once we start up again, it's going to be a big
year.
Well,
I've had to think hard about it. Instead of in my meetings, I've learned to sort of go down a few octaves because I have a bit of a booming voice when I present and I talk rather loud, and I'm trying to keep that as low as possible.
You have to control it.
Because the louder I talk, the less airtime I have. My voice will disappear very, very quickly.
Run
so,
out.
You know, and that's and that's a very important thing for all of the people who are going to be presenting the game. You know, and we try and instill that into every single presentation is that, you know, we try and keep the noise levels in our room down so that you're not having to shout. Because once you start shouting,
keep your battery full.
Yeah, your voice goes.
Funny. All right, our second question. In several screenshots, Lara has a rough, handmade-looking bone axe, whereas later she receives a shiny-looking metal one. Is this an example of the gear gating and progression that you've talked about?
Yeah, so this is something that we've shown. So I think that, you know, we've been very clear with people about gear gating and about sort of how when you begin the game, you have to evolve and evolve in a way of you've landed with nothing and you have to, through your skills, sort of improve who you are and your abilities. And, you know, in some of the demos that we showed last year, of course, you know, we've showed her with this makeshift axe, and obviously over time we'll start to expose how she gets it and why she gets it and how she uses it. But then, you know, we also showed sort of Roth giving Lara a climbing axe. So, yeah, we've presented, we've talked about the idea of gear gating, and that's a very important part of it. And we look forward to presenting how that fits into the overarching story and the game and the character development and her personality over the next couple of months.
Great. This is one that I like. Will there be a Play Arts Kai Lara Croft figure? Some people are trying to connect some dots.
It's not hard to connect those dots. It's Play Arts Kai. We are looking at an entire, a pretty extensive array of licensed products. Of course, as Tomb Raider, we're being very, very picky about what we do and how much we put out there. But we're blown away by, you know, the Adam Jensens and the Final Fantasies and the Metal Gear Solids of the world. So anybody who could see my office right now, Megan's looking at my shelf. We have loads of stuff from the Batman Arkham Asylum to Deus Ex to Metal Gear. I collect them all. I'm a big fan, so I'm not going to give away any scoops here, but you just have to wait and see whether or not we do. You know, I'm a big fan, but that's all I'm going to say.
We'll see. All right. Here's another very specific question that I got from a big fan on Tumblr. The majority of Tomb Raider titles, Lara has a dark and sarcastic sort of humor. Is this inherent to her personality still, or is it a product of experiences that she's yet to have in this early stage?
Again, with the presentations we've been doing over the last 12 plus months, we've been very careful in sort of making sure we present Lara as this young and ambitious character. She hasn't been out in the world and done this before. So she's kind of wanting to learn and evolve. And, you know, she was ambitious enough to want to get on the ship and go on this journey in the first place. So we want to make sure that the character is of today. This is her first time. So, you know, in past Tomb Raiders, yes, there's been a sort of an amount of arrogance or, you know, sarcasm in her voice mm-hmm. when she says certain things. That's not a trait that you'll find in this Lara, and certainly not a trait that we currently have in the plans to ever shine through. We want the player to kind of have an emotional attachment to this character and sort of see a personality which they feel is relevant to today. It's a bit, you know, again, it gets back to all the relevance that we've given in the past about IPs, is that what James Bond said in the 60s is not what James Bond says today. Mm-hmm. And if you were to take what he said 40 years ago and apply it to a character today, people would look at it and go, I don't understand why or how relevant that is to today's audience. So we're very, very careful about the character exploration and development. And again, we're not going to get into spoilers and telling you what she does or doesn't say. But, you know, we've made it very clear in the press demos that we've given. We show a side to Lara where even she doesn't believe that she's a Croft and she has to grow and she has to become somebody.
Great. All right, the final question, this one actually is kind of parallels the Play Arts Kai one. This is pretty popular on the forums, actually. Square Enix seems to be embracing a high degree of crossovers and content post-launch, such as with Final Fantasy XIII, too. Is there any potential for this in Tomb Raider, some sort of crossover within the company, externally, costumes, something along those lines?
Right now, there is absolutely nothing planned. Our goal is to work on the single player, and I think it would be kind of strange to have Lara be on an island and then come across
Ezio or Gears of War. Yeah, that'd be kind of strange. Final Fantasy character.
Yeah, so right now, no, there is no plan whatsoever to do any crossovers. And I don't see on the horizon right now, but, you know, never say never. There's always opportunities. I think there's many products out there who left until the very last minute to add in something which they felt was relevant, and they did, and it worked. But right now, no, we don't have anything.
Focused.
It's focus. It's all about Lara.
Well, thank you for those answers, Carl, and for your time, and enjoy the rest of the day.
No problem. Always a pleasure. I look forward to seeing you again next month, although you sit outside my office all day.
All right, bye.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so before closing out the show, we have Casey Manning, one of our recruiters, back So welcome back. And what do you got for us this month on the hiring front?
Hey, Megan. Great to be back. Well, yeah, we're still hard at work at hiring for all types of positions. We've had some great fills lately, and we're still looking for strong lead and senior technical talent, as well as really talented artists at the senior level. We're always on the lookout for great artists and designers.
All right. And specifically leading into E3, you had a couple of updates?
Yeah, absolutely. So our recruiting team is getting prepared for E3, and we're very excited to be back in the fun of everything this year. Something we're doing this year that's a lot of fun is we would definitely like to meet specifically with any lead engineers or senior engineers that might be at E3 this year. We might have a few fun things planned for you. More details will follow probably later in May. But to anybody who is interested in syncing up with us, please feel free to email me directly at Crystal. My email address is cmanning@crystald.com, or send your resume with a note in the cover letter to resume@jobvite.com, or just apply directly on our website at www.crystald.com under the job section.
Right, so if you're attending E3 and meet the criteria, just pencil it into your notebook for now. Reminder, meet up with Crystal.
Yeah, we'll take you out and show you a good time, promise.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for popping in.
No problem. Thanks, Megan.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's all for today. Whereas this space has previously been reserved for the Tomb Raider Trivia Challenge, as mentioned last month, we are going to let that contest live on our social media outlets from this time forward to make sure that participation is accessible for fans worldwide. Our next Trivia Challenge will start on May 1st, and we'll share info via all of the major social media outlets such as Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook, so keep an eye on those spaces. Thanks for listening!